Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 23rd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Folks, I cannot tell a lie. We are not here. We are still basking in, what do they call that, tryptophan? Ugh, so hackneyed. So tired of hearing about tryptophan. We had turkey yesterday. Some of us maybe did not have turkey. Some of us had maybe tofurkey. Something like that. Hopefully your Thanksgiving was pleasurable. You made it through dealing with your relatives, if that's what you chose to deal with. I am quite sure that I will have some stories to tell on Monday. But I may not tell them to you because they may be inappropriate. They may be inappropriate, and I don't want to single out any of my family members. All that said, folks, we do have a new interview for you today. On the program, an interview I did a couple days ago with Alex Rosenblatt, author of Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. It's an ethnographic look into Uber. The author, she spent a lot of time driving around with Uber drivers, talking to them and thinking about the implications of work. Fascinating stuff. We will get there in just a minute. First, I should tell you that today's support for today's show comes from Be Frugal. If you're an online shopper, you have to try Be Frugal. Be Frugal lets you earn cash back from over 5,000 stores, including Amazon, Walmart, Target, Macy's, and more. Simply find the online store, click on the BeFrugal.com link. That's BeFrugal.com to activate cash back and complete your purchase. Or you can download the Be Frugal extension for your browser to automatically apply coupon codes and activate cash back as you shop. They add the best deals from around the web every day, and you'll earn the highest cash back rates guaranteed, up to 40%, accessible via PayPal, direct deposit, gift card, or check. Find everything from electronics, clothing, and footwear to home goods, beauty, toys, travel, more, all of it. You're already shopping online. Why not get paid for it? Even earn cash back on your holiday shopping. Visit BeFrugal.com/majority and get a $10 bonus when you join for free. That's BeFrugal.com/majority. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Alex Rosenblatt, author of Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. And we will be back live on Monday with the full complement of Majority Report HQ staff, as opposed to the non-HQ staff. Okay, quick break. Be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Alex Rosenblatt. She is a researcher at the Data and Society Research Institute. She is a technology ethnographer and, of course, author of the book Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. Alex, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, all right, let's just start with this. What exactly did you do in the course of writing essentially this this study of, I guess, of Uber drivers and their experience?
Well, since about 2014, I've been doing an ethnography of Uber drivers, and that basically means that I've been learning from strangers. And so I've traveled across more than 25 cities in the United States and in Canada, traveled more than 5,000 miles riding around in cars, and interviewed over 125 drivers, although I've observed hundreds more on the road. In addition, I've actually spent a lot of time online. Drivers have formed networks and groups on the internet where they share information. And so the groups I follow, which could be Facebook groups or they could include driver-dedicated websites, collectively had about 300,000 members by the end of 2017.
So why? Like, what drew you to this? What was the I think when ethnographers go into the field, as it were, they don't necessarily have any, or maybe they do, some pre-existing assumptions or theses. How did you enter into this and why?
When I was starting on this project, Uber was still the darling of the business and tech beat, and it was a very promising example of the sharing economy, which was a sort of movement in the early, well, I'll say just after the Great Recession. And after the Great Recession, people had experienced broad losses. They might have lost their jobs. There were foreclosure crises. And in that moment, Uber and Airbnb and other technology companies emerged onto the scene and said, hey, we've got a solution. We can offer, you know, temporary ways to earn money, or we can offer, in Uber's case, entrepreneurship for the masses by using technology to scale opportunities for people to share underutilized assets or skills and make some money at a time when people really needed that. And so I was really captivated by the rhetoric of sharing, because it seemed like a promise that might be masking something at the same time. Because when you ask people to work, you call it sharing, there's always something just a bit suspicious about that. But initially, I was quite drawn into one promise that seemed to hold up quite well, which is that there had been longstanding problems for people to be able to hail a cab, particularly for people of color, and especially for men of color who might be passed over by a cab driver who might instead choose to pick up a nearby white passenger. And so there was this constant issue of curbside discrimination, and Uber came along and said, hey, we've got a policy of blind passenger acceptance. And so drivers have limited information about the passenger before they accept the dispatch. And that seemed to resolve a problem, which was really neat. And so we started, at the time, myself and my research partner, Luke Stark, started looking into Uber as an example of the promise of the sharing economy to examine, you know, its actual impact, and because it seemed to have a social contribution to society that would promote equality. And it turned out that that policy that we were so interested in actually was one of a larger system of policies that were either implicit or explicit on Uber's platform that affected how drivers were managed at work.
Okay, and that last sentence is pretty loaded, and I want to get there. I just want to put a pin in that for a moment, because we should also there seems to be a distinct there seems to be a significant distinction between so-called ride sharing companies, which are really, you know, or let's just leave the, you know, accept that for the moment, ride sharing companies, and Uber is a distinction, right? There's a specific culture associated with Uber, as there is, that may or may not be indicative of all ride sharing. And there's also a distinction between Uber and sort of, I guess, the gig economy. But starting at that level, like, to what extent did you find in the course of your research, what were broad stroke sharing economy principles that you found in terms of the relationship between, I guess, Well, I mean, they claim not employer, but what were broad strokes sort of, you know, gig economy points did you find?
Well, I would say that Uber has been a dominant marketplace actor for ride hailing, and I'm not sure that other ride hailing companies with similar heft are that distinct from Uber and its own practices. I would say the difference is that Uber has been engulfed in many more scandals. But the employment practices across Uber and then maybe across Lyft and across Juno, for example, which is a local one to New York City, have a lot in common, even while they carve out some distinct differences, like better customer service, for example, towards drivers. But ride sharing, which is a more popular term to describe Uber, is part of how it participated in the sharing economy promise. And the sharing economy was about, you know, creating access to new job opportunities, new income earning opportunities, but through a type of work that wasn't necessarily a job. It was through a form of social contribution or social reciprocity, and it drew on a longer legacy of cooperative commerce like carpooling or couch surfing, except it banked on our assumptions about what that looks like on the internet. And so a good example of that might be Wikipedia, where you have crowds of strangers who are contributing edits to form a global encyclopedia of knowledge. And that idea that we're all just contributors is an assumption that Uber leveraged to sort of style the work it was offering as a form of sharing. But upon closer inspection, drivers aren't, of course, driving you from A to B because they want to share their car, even while they might also enjoy the affective benefit of talking to passengers, like the social benefits. At the end of the day, they're largely doing it for money because it's a job.
I mean, you know, it's tough coming from New York in terms of like my perspective of these ride sharing. And I happen to use Juno, you know, just because there's something about Uber that I find not good. But a lot of these, it's fundamentally different, isn't it, in some of the big cities relative to other places, because most of the Juno drivers, they seem to be, you know, professionals on some level, speak to that difference, you know, regionally as to, you know, who does these.
That has to do more with New York, which is a bit of an anomaly across Uberland. New York has had a robust taxi industry, and a lot of the drivers who started working for Uber and Lyft and Juno and others came from an occupational background of driving. They might previously have experience as taxi drivers or even as truck drivers. And another major distinction is that the cost to entry in New York City is higher than it is in other places because it's regulated. The drivers have to obtain licenses and permits through the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission. They have to undergo some training. They have to get TLC license plates. They have to get commercial insurance. And in other cities, drivers just need a driver's license, a car that meets Uber or Lyft standards, and personal insurance. They have to pass a light background check, and they can be on the road and working within a couple of days, which is quite remarkable. But in New York City, the cost to entry is higher because you have all of these additional requirements. And so it's not quite, you know, the pool of drivers who might say, okay, let me try and do this for 10 hours a week or 15 hours a week. The majority of drivers in New York City are doing this to earn their livelihoods.
And so, okay, so for those people who are not like the drivers in New York, when they do this, like, how does their, where do their expectations start and where do they end up? Or I should say, what are those expectations met?
I'd say there's some variation for how drivers have their expectations to begin with or what they want from it. I mean, there's drivers like Tedesi, who was in Washington, D.C., and he used to take Lyft home at the end of the night at the bar. And so he was familiar with it and thought, you know, why don't I try driving for these services as well? When I met him, he was driving for Lyft and also, you know, considering driving for Uber. In other cases, you know, people have seen advertisements, like you could make $90,000 a year or you could make $30 an hour. And they thought, hey, you know, like, let me give this a shot. for people who were coming out of an environment where they felt quite monitored and surveilled and like a call center, Uber and Lyft and the like felt like a more independent opportunity to potentially earn more money. For a driver like Nathan, who was in LA, he's trained as a social worker and provides psychotherapy sessions for his clients. And he started driving ride-hail because he wanted to have a social connection with passengers that was lighter than what he had to absorb from passengers and patients who had really serious mental health concerns and distress, like PTSD. And so you get kind of a wide variety. I mean, I remember meeting drivers who just had leisure time or a spare vehicle sitting in their driveway, and they said, hey, you know, my son is kind of teasing me for having this big old SUV in my driveway. I'm going to show him and, like, go sign up to drive for Uber and start driving people around. So you got quite a range. And then there'd be people who, you know, whose business went under, and they needed to find a source of income really quickly.
Did those different types of people who go in, did they have a fundamentally different experience, or how they experienced the relationship with Uber? Was it markedly different or similar?
I would say it's quite different. The people who feel, I think, most successful on these platforms are either the optimizers, who are really good at being responsive to the different gamified forms of work that these platforms have. So when there's particular incentive that you can get paid a premium to work in a particular place at a particular time, like, they were very responsive to those, and they could always eke out a pretty decent income, or at least they were excited by the challenge. And there's others for whom, if they're not economically dependent on driving to earn their livelihoods, they tend to have a bit of a better experience because they might be doing it for supplemental money. It could be to pay discrete bills, even those when those bills are quite important, like you're paying a healthcare bill or you're saving up for your daughter's college tuition, or because you want to start your own business. You know, you still might have another job, and so you're not quite as reliant on it, which means that when Uber unilaterally changes the rates at which you earn per minute and per mile, which it does, and it's often implemented rate cuts that drivers really chafe at, you're not as affected by those rate cuts if you're a part-time driver rather than if you're a full-time driver who relies on this work more.
So let's talk about the concept of you know, allowing these people to perceive themselves or to be entrepreneurs. I mean, how does that, is that promise real in the sense that, like, the if there is that dynamic of Uber can just change the rate structure overnight or something like that? Is there genuine room for entrepreneurship, or are they just basically just, you know, providing labor?
What I found in my research with drivers over 4 years is that drivers do not have entrepreneurial freedom to make decisions in their own best interest. And that's because they have both information and power asymmetries from the platform. So, for example, Uber's in charge of setting the rates, and drivers can negotiate lower pay but not higher. When they have to accept the dispatch, they don't know where the passenger wants to go or how much the value of that trip is. If they decline a trip because they're sitting in a surge pricing zone and they specifically went there so they could try and get a premium on their next ride, and Uber dispatches them, you know, a non-surge price ride, they might get a notification that says, hey, you know, we're going to deactivate you if you keep up this surge manipulation. And deactivate is just a word that means suspended or fired. And so what I started to find was that drivers, in fact, didn't have the information they needed to make informed decisions. And even when they did try to, you know, exert their autonomy, there were situations in which Uber would threaten to punish them, such as by firing them if they did that.
So how are the algorithms changing the work dynamic? It sounds like the algorithms are just basically, you know, the person who works for the boss, and the boss doesn't want to be the bad guy.
That's a little bit like that. I mean, instead of having hundreds of or thousands of human supervisors who monitor drivers and, you know, help them do a better job, you have algorithms that are basically just rules encoded in software. And when I say, you know, algorithms are managing drivers, it's really about an ecosystem where there's a number of different algorithms and also, you know, automated customer support. And, like, they're part of an ecosystem in which the interaction or the relationship between Uber and its drivers is one that is conducted through automated or technical communications. And so you have like different levers to try and get drivers to behave in particular ways and to standardize the services they provide across, you know, hundreds of cities without having a human manager looking over your shoulder. On the other hand, having an app collect data on your every move can be a much more granular form of workplace surveillance than you might experience in a comparable setting with a human boss. And that's kind of interesting because a lot of drivers might prefer the feeling of independence that comes from, you know, choosing when to get in the car and start working, and they enjoy and benefit from the scheduling flexibility they have. On the other hand, they have, you know, a boss who's going to intervene when they brake too harshly or accelerate too quickly. It's going to send them an in-app notification or an email or a text message. And it'll do the same when drivers try and log off, for example. You might be tired, kind of ready to go home, or you have to go pick up your daughter, and another ride request comes through. But maybe there's even a technical problem. Maybe when it's supposed to be on your screen for 15 seconds, it's only there for like 2 seconds. And then it counts against what's called your ride acceptance rate. And so there are these increasingly like detailed aspects to the rules where if drivers have signed up, for example, to be paid an incentive, like a guarantee of $40 an hour if you behave in the following listicle of ways, but then they miss a ride acceptance, and that could ding them for the whole night and make them lose the entire incentive they were working towards. And so they have to keep working. You know, like this is not a perfect technical system, but there's also a lot of ways in which Uber has carved out forms of shift work for drivers who then have to match the incentives by performing particular behaviors.
So, I mean, aside from what sounds like a very good argument that Uber drivers are misclassified as a way of Uber trying to avoid, you know, taking the responsibility that employer has for employees. How do the drivers themselves, how conscious are they of the dynamic you just spoke of? That in some respects, they're being more efficiently monitored and corralled, and just like with flexible hours, essentially.
I think it can take some time. I think there's different sort of evolutionary stages of the driver experience. At the beginning, it might feel more free. You know, you can log in and log out at will. But, you know, you might be that if you're working in a job where your working conditions are a reflection of changes in the market, that might mean that the premium time to work is when you have to pick up your kids from school. And so you might be trying to engage in on-demand work because of the flexible schedule, but you might be corralled into working at particular times in particular places anyways if you're dependent on this work to earn your livelihood. I would say that where drivers sort of meet the algorithm face-to-face is almost where when they have a problem. And so while they were quick to get started working, they rarely have all the information they need to manage all of the exigencies of this job. So if you have a pastor who harasses you or smokes in your vehicle, you know, what do you do? And there's not really a good form of grievance channels for drivers. And that's when they start to become more aware that although they're being monitored, you know, there's not a lot of accountability in that system of surveillance. And that's when there's more chafe because you start to run into issues of fairness. Like, hey, I wasn't paid for 11 trips. I was paid for 10. And you have to email back and forth with a remote customer service agency, possibly located in the Philippines, to try and get, you know, your payment. And so you start to see that despite the fact that there's an overlay of technology that creates distance between Uber and its drivers and their working relationship, there's also the typical workplace issues that come up, which is like, what do you do when things go wrong? How do you handle harassment? How do you handle discrimination? How do you handle potential wage theft?
How much, I mean, it does strike me as like one of those like classic scenes at the restaurant where the customer can say, let me see your manager, and the manager comes over and the customer gets some satisfaction from it. But there's no opportunity for that person who's working there to go to their manager and say, this customer is acting like a jerk. There's no opportunity there. It only goes one way. Well, let me ask you this. With all the monitoring, I mean, you talk about how you write about how the phone, can measure how gracefully they stop at stoplights and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, down to every action they take when they take their breaks, when they log on to work and log off. Does Uber sell that information? Like, they have data on the customers, but they also seem to have an enormous wealth of data on their workers. And I would imagine they have sort of supplementary data to sort of say, like, someone who makes this amount of money, you can expect them to work this much. Or, you know, like, do they have data on their workers that they sell to other enterprises?
I don't know whether or not they sell that data, but certainly the collection of it should give a lot of people pause, and not just drivers. So, for example, when ride-hail companies offer a promotion to drive you to the polling, sorry, to vote, you know, you got to wonder, okay, now maybe they've acquired a list of people who are going to vote, and maybe which direction they might vote in. Like, who knows? There's lots of ways in which data collection, for one purpose, can be converted into another application that consumers of technology might not consider appropriate.
Yeah, at one point, Uber was using it as a way of basically leveraging the coverage they got, right? Because there was the story of the reporter, and they were spying
right.
on some reporters, right? There's a, I mean,
they were. They did track the arrival of a reporter to her meeting with one of the Uber regional managers. And, of course, they've had to enter into consent decrees with the Federal Trade Commission over data privacy violations. They're certainly not unique in having challenges when it comes to data collection and issues of privacy, consumer privacy, and social norms around data use, but they've really stood out because they've had so many scandals.
In a lot of instances, Uber basically came in, broke local laws, right, and just sort of created facts on the ground. Also developed a lot of political relationships, both with, like, you know, national parties and whatnot. To what extent, and we've seen this, you know, sort of almost like with Airbnb as well, to a lesser degree, but in some instances you've got, like, you know, small towns where hotels are saying, like, hey, wait a second, we've got all these regulations. This is just a way of skirting it. To what extent do the drivers, do they have a perspective on that?
On whether or not that
the company is skirting the laws? Yeah. I mean, to what extent do they have a consciousness of the way this business model was settled was basically to break the laws? And to what extent are they aware that some of these laws were built to protect people like myself?
So this also depends on the evolutionary stages of drivers across Uberland. And I'll give you an example. When I was doing field work in Montreal, Quebec, back in early 2016, drivers were risking fines and attack by aggressive taxi drivers and fines and having their cars impounded by the transportation police to work on the Uber underground. Because when Uber first arrives to a new city, it argues that it identifies as a technology company, and therefore the rules that regulate the transportation industry and their transportation competitors, like the taxi business, do not apply. And so it still has to create a base. And so what it does is it recruits drivers to work on the underground, and it compensates them for the risk they take by paying their fines or replacing their vehicles if they're impounded, you know, until they become legitimate in the city after they've, you know, established a base of services. And to do that, they'll leverage their popular support with consumers and use them almost like a political constituency. They'll text them or write them messages and say, you know, hey, this city or this particular government official or this regulator wants to shut us down and, like, take away these services that benefit everyone so much. You know, why don't you call them or, like, help vote in our favor for any pending legislation that might affect its business model in ways it doesn't like. And so there's this interesting dynamic where there can be this moment of regulatory forbearance that even when the laws exist that could be used to constrain activities that might be considered illegal, even while they're quite popular, you know, there's a moment of pause because it does provide, you know, an efficient service that a lot of people really enjoy. And so do you want to be the regulator who says, like, I'm shutting this thing down that you enjoy so much? And so it plays this kind of game, and drivers are initially enlisted to participate in the cause by working on the underground. I mean, they're signed up to work in cities where Uber hasn't even officially arrived. I've been interviewing taxi drivers, you know, in Vancouver years ago who have had the Uber app on their phones for years, and that's because they're ready for when Uber finally launches there. And that's Uber's, you know, playbook, right? It gets to a new city, it recruits, and it tries to launch before it's legal. And that's its strategy. And then by the time there's a sort of full-hearted objection to its services, it's already popular, and it says, well, hey, are you really going to shut us down? And that's when they enter into conflicts with cities that try and say, okay, let's accommodate you, but also we would like to safeguard our constituents, such as by requiring that your drivers have fingerprint-based background checks, as the city of Austin did. And at that moment, Uber and even Lyft, in Austin's case, might say, hey, if you try and pass this legislation and you succeed, we're going to pull out of town, which is remarkable because, you know, everyone's quite familiar with the mostly apocryphal story of a factory that says, hey, if you don't give me a tax break, I'm going to leave. Like, I'm going to outsource to Mexico or something like that. But in the case
I'm going to leave Washington State and go to South Carolina, you know, if I'm Boeing or something like that.
Exactly.
And it happens, right.
And they can just shut off the app. You know, it's remarkable. You don't have to shut down a factory. You can leave everybody stranded, which is exactly what happened to both drivers who had relied on this for their income and the passengers, you know, in Austin when they left in 2016. And so you find that, like, the sense of awareness that people have about what it means for a disruptive Silicon Valley company to arrive can really evolve over time.
And do the drivers, though, come to see, like, hey, wait a second, this may be a problem. We could use some regulation, or no? I mean, my understanding is, I haven't been to Austin since that happened, but my understanding in Austin that they've come up with all sorts of different alternatives.
They did. Austin was very quick to source alternatives, although I think Uber and Lyft are back now. And so it's kind of tricky because even if a local startup is successful, you know, as soon as Uber and Lyft return, it's like, well, we've got this like global contingent of passengers who already have this app downloaded to their phone. So they have this quite significant marketplace power, even if there are local alternatives. And there's, you know, when I was in Austin, drivers didn't particularly object to taking, you know, fingerprint-based background checks, which they had like many months to do. And they were pissed because they felt that the cities, that the companies had pulled out of town without regard to how drivers relied on it for their income. They might have bought new cars to start this work, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, Uber made morally persuasive arguments that fingerprint-based background checks would basically feed into a criminal justice system that disproportionately affects people of color and African Americans. And so their argument was that, you know, we shouldn't have to impose this on our workforce. But if you look just slightly beneath that logic, there's also the fact that Uber and Lyft rely on a very high churn of drivers through a system. Their business model relies on people being able to sign up and get to work, you know, in under a week, for example. And fingerprint-based background checks are a much more stringent form. They have to go through, like, often FBI records, for example, and they could take 4 months. And so you wouldn't be able to sign up drivers as readily, you know, if you permitted this accommodation that the city was legislating towards.
Yeah, I probably take a little bit of a jaundiced view on their on Uber's concern for social justice. But be that that may be more of a reflection of me than them. But all right. So lastly, let me ask you this: did you ever come across any attempt of drivers to basically form some type of co-op version of Uber or to unionize in some fashion? Because if it is just a technology at the end of the day, technologies can be replicated. Certainly, like I say, I use Juno. It's just in New York, and it's really just a question of adoption. But if all the drivers, you know, had decided that they're going to use a, you know, a co-op type of system, that seems to be feasible in some way. Was there ever talk of that, or did Or are people who, you know, who want to drive for a living tend to be sort of more independent in some fashion?
I would say that a lot of drivers have an idea of independence that even if they haven't achieved it as Uber and Lyft drivers, you know, desire it. And I would also reflect that I think a lot of the discussions about co-ops have probably come from more like political views or academics who are interested in platform cooperativism and in sort of bringing out the promise of the sharing economy. I don't think it's a popular alternative among drivers, although certainly in different cities, both taxi companies have developed their own apps, which is not to say that they're a co-op. And also, there's been local solutions across different cities. But that doesn't get at the global network effects of Uber.
Interesting. Well, the book is Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. Alex Rosenblatt, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was great speaking with you, Sam. Thank you.